Frank Garcia is a prisoner in Texas. By the end of the show, he'll be dead. This is Execution Watch. Huntsville, Texas, death penalty capital of the Western world, where final preparations are underway to execute Garcia by injecting him with massive doses of drugs made to save lives. Over the next hour, KPFT's Execution Watch will provide live coverage and commentary on the state killing. Execution Watch host Ray Hill, legal analyst Jim Skelton, guest attorneys Susan Ashley and Larry Douglas, Huntsville reporter outside the death house, Gloria Rubeck, Houston Vigil reporter Nancy Bailey, and special guest Victoria Panetti, sister of Texas death row prisoner Scott Panetti. The Execution Watch begins.
And here we are. You're listening to KPFT HD3 channel, and I am Ray Hill. We have an execution watch this evening. The execution is for Frank Garcia, and Frank has been scheduled to be executed. We have been in touch with the Attorney General's office in Austin, as well as folks in Washington, D.C., a last-minute appeal based on Mr. Garcia's possible mental retardation has been filed with the high court. At last word, the Texas response to that appeal was being drafted and would be electronically sent to Washington, D.C. for Supreme Court action. I am Ray Hill, and I am the host of today's program. This program is possible because it was conceptualized by Elizabeth Ann Stein some time ago, whenever we here at KPFT concluded that they weren't doing enough about executions. On tonight's show, you've already heard Larry Douglas's wonderful voice. Jim Skelton and Susan Ashley are both in the studio. Victoria Panetti is somewhere out there trying to get to the studio. She's scheduled to be our interview, but last report we had from the Greyhound bus station is that she had not made it to Houston from Livingston. At Huntsville, we have Gloria Rubeck, and we're going to put Gloria on the phone now. And Gloria, are you there? Gloria.
Hello.
Gloria. Gloria.
Hello?
Are you there?
Oh, yes, I'm here.
Okay, tell us what's going on.
Well, aside from dozens and dozens of cops assembling, not too much is going on. The execution is still on hold because there's still appeals pending. Two TV stations from San Antonio were getting ready to do live broadcasts of the witnesses crossing the street, but that isn't happening yet. So we're just waiting to see what the Supreme Court does. I understand there's a case out of Arizona, I believe, Martinez case, that has to do with evidence your state habeas attorney neglected to file, but it should be allowed by your federal habeas attorneys to be used. So one of the issues that's before the Supreme Court is that his execution should be held up until this Martinez case is settled, because his state attorneys did not present the evidence of mental retardation that they should have.
Okay, let me repeat that so that the lawyers here can hear it. They don't have headphones. There is a Martinez case. You got it?
Yeah.
The Martinez case. Yeah, they're familiar with the Martinez case, so they can pick that up and carry it with. But as far as you know, that is the pending issue before the Supreme Court of the United States. And according to information Elizabeth was able to glean, the state's response to that has yet to be filed.
Well, that's what she told me about 30, 40 minutes ago, and I have no earthly idea how long it takes them to file, and then how long it would take the Supreme or Scalia to make a decision. So I guess we could be here for a little while.
Yeah, let me explain to the audience what happens. When you call the Supreme Court of the United States at the last minute in a Texas execution, the phone is supposed to be answered by Antonin Scalia, and he's not necessarily the person you want to answer the phone. However, in recent cases, he has found an issue complex enough to want to submit it to other justices before rendering an opinion on it. We went through one of those not too long ago where the execution actually happened after 8 o'clock, as I recall.
Right.
So that could be a hitch in the come along. Now, when we do execution watch, we explain all of the machinations that we are aware of that are going on so that folks listening can understand how complicated these things can be. Gloria Ruback, who is active in the abolition movement, is in Huntsville, Texas, at the in front of the death house. Now, what is the logistics of the cop demonstration versus the other anti-execution demonstration?
Well, the cops are on the... we're blocked from the street in front of the death house by crime scene tape.
Yep.
The cops are allowed to mill around on the prison property. And as far as I can see from here, there's probably 24 and maybe more because I can't see over the hill. And they're over there talking to the news media. We have a good group. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. There's 10 of us out here.
Okay.
There's 10 people at the Capitol in Austin, and I don't know about the other locations. So we are outnumbered, but the cops only come out here when a cop has been killed. So they're not normally here.
And they are provided charter buses by the law enforcement agencies and unions of their area.
Yeah. Now, I didn't see a bus. In fact, I've seen several cop cars drive up, so I think they carpooled.
No, there was a notice on the website in San Antonio how to get to the chartered bus and get on it in time.
Okay. I got
advance word of that. That's been out for more than 3 or 4 days.
Oh, okay. My computer's been off.
Yeah.
I do want to give a message to the guys on death row that this has not happened. And if you're a friend of...
Well, Gloria, tonight we're on HD3 channel, so the guys on death row can't hear it. So this is one of those cases because of the fundraising activities going on KPFT.
I totally forgot.
That nobody on the row can hear it. However, they'll be listening to the prison show tomorrow night, I am sure.
Right. So, anyway, things are just at a standstill here right now. There's a lot of cops, and for some reason, the little man up at the guard tower on the corner, who probably has a little brain and a little something else, is holding a giant gun, which I guess is supposed to be intimidating us. I'm on the radio just a second.
Yeah, well, I don't think that particular crowd is intimidated by disproportionate guns.
I'm sure he usually has it in that little guardhouse up there, but for some reason he's holding it upright tonight.
He's brandishing it.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And if anything happens, of course, get in touch with Elizabeth right away.
I will. I sure will.
Okay, thank you.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And while we've got the phones up, let's check on Nancy Bailey. Hello, Nancy.
All right, how you doing?
I am fine. Where are you?
Well, I'm on the corner of Almeda and Holcomb in front of the Dominican Sisters.
Almeda and Holcomb in front. That's right, kind of across the street from the VA hospital.
Yes, indeed.
And how many folks have you got out there with you?
Well, it's a relatively small group. We've got 7 right now. A lot of our people are out of town right now.
Okay, did David not make it back from Livingston?
No, Elizabeth said he was apparently going to try, but as of right now, he's not here.
Okay, I can tell the folks, because we've got a hold on the execution.
They do have a hold?
The witnesses...
Based on what?
Well, there's a last-minute appeal to the Supreme Court based on... two issues. One issue is the is it viable to raise in federal appellate writ appeals issues not brought up in the state appellate writ appeal. And his lawyer left out a retardation issue. And so they're trying to get the right to argue that issue before the Supreme Court. And there's some mix up on that. So as of present, no witnesses have crossed the road in Huntsville. And you know what that means. So
that's interesting.
So it's on appeal. We're proceeding with the show as if we're doing a breaking news story.
Uh-huh.
And if we get any word of action in Huntsville, we'll interrupt our show to tell about that.
Okay.
But could you, Nancy is with the Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, Texas Coalition to Abolish the Death Penalty, and that organization can be reached at tcadp.org. And so, Nancy, give our regards to the other vigilants.
I certainly will. I'll tell them that you are carrying on. I'll tell them what's going on. And we appreciate everything y'all are doing.
And
it's a wonderful program.
When Elizabeth gets different words, she will notify you. If we're on the air, we'll be on the air until about 7 o'clock, and after that, we'll have to revert to the regular news program for information.
Okay, so we're going to hang up now.
Thank you very much, Nancy.
Okay, well.
Bye-bye.
Later. Bye.
And that's Nancy Bailey, and Nancy is out at the Dominican Sisters compound out on Holcomb Boulevard. And those are the two vigils we're going to cover, incidentally. To find out more about the good work of Gloria Ruback, you can go to Abolition Movement. That's A-B-O-L-I-T-I-O-N movement.org. Abolitionmovement.org. And since Gloria keeps that website up, you can get directly in touch with her. Now back to the man of the night, Frank Garcia. Frank Garcia turned 39 on Friday. And he was convicted of a shooting death of his wife. I think, did his brother-in-law die, too?
No, he was shot in the leg.
Was shot but survived. And a San Antonio police officer. I suppose Susan is going to tell us what happened in this incident.
Well, the facts are kind of simple in this case. What happened was, on March 29th, 01, Frank Garcia, at that time, was married to a woman named Jessica. They had two children, and Garcia, Jessica, the two children, lived in a home along with Frank Garcia's parents. Apparently, Jessica wanted to leave him, and she called relatives and friends to come over to help her move her things and leave the home. And what ended up happening is apparently Frank Garcia did not want her to leave, and it ended up that Frank had her cornered in the bedroom, and a San Antonio police officer came in, and when the San Antonio police officer came in, Frank Garcia had his back towards the officer, and he apparently turned around and he shot the officer, I think, twice. Then he shot his wife, and I believe he shot the officer in the head again after he shot Jessica. And that's basically what happened. And then after that, other officers came, he was arrested, and that's your basic facts.
Okay, did he shoot his brother-in-law, is it?
Yes, and then apparently he ran out of the house. And I guess you could say whoever was there was in danger, because apparently he shot his brother-in-law, Mr. Luna. He got shot in the leg, and he was able to get away. Also, Mr. Garcia continued, I guess, to shoot and to spray bullets around, and he shot at a school, which I guess damaged the door or something. But nobody else was killed. And then, I guess at some point, he ran out of bullets, he went inside, and he got an assault rifle and came out and continued to shoot.
So there was a lot of bullets in this case.
Yes.
A lot of bullets, and the police didn't return fire, they just arrested him, said, hey, you put down the gun, let's go.
Well, I imagine they probably, it happened so fast that it took a minute or two to get backup units there. The original shooting rampage, I don't think there would be any other, once the officer was shot in the bedroom, I don't think there was anyone else outside to shoot him.
Well, was there anything in the trial? Well, let's flip over to Jim. Jim, what about this? Why is this not? Well, I guess if your wife leaving, that's not an unusual circumstance these days. So it's certainly not one of passion, but what is the defense in this case, if any?
It'd be hard to defend this case because, like I say, he shot him. The last time he shot at somebody was at a school, but there's a superintendent of the school was nearby and barely missed the superintendent of school. And I think the reason the police didn't shoot him by the time backup got there, he's out of bullets. He shot everything out. So at that point, what I'd like to do, Ray, is talk about the issue that's pending for the Supreme Court because it's kind of convoluted and not a lot of people have understood it. I pulled all the cases off the Supreme Court today, so I'm fairly familiar with it. To get there, you have to understand the appellate procedure in criminal cases and death penalty cases. When you're convicted of a death penalty case, there's a direct appeal that goes to the Court of Criminal Appeals. You're entitled to an appointed lawyer on that direct appeal. Mm-hmm. If he doesn't do his job, you can claim the lawyer is ineffective and get relief. Now, once that direct appeal is over with, up until recently on post-conviction writ, you were on your own. But now they've got a procedure where you can now appoint lawyers for the post-conviction writ. Problem is, back in 1974, there was an old Supreme Court case that said, since lawyers don't have to be appointed on collateral appeals, meaning in other words for writs, you can't claim that lawyer is ineffective. So ineffective points cannot be raised if the lawyer that does the writ doesn't do a good job. That's an old 1974 Supreme Court case. Now, what's now pending for the U.S. Supreme Court is a case out of Arizona. It's the Martinez case versus Arizona. And what happened in that case, Arizona is a lot like Texas. They appoint lawyers on direct appeal. They also appoint lawyers to do writs. And in Martinez's case, a writ lawyer filed a writ claiming there's no merit to his writ. It's like an Anders brief saying it's a no-error deal. And so what happened, she did not have Martinez's permission to file that writ. She did it pretty much on her own.
Okay.
So he filed a subsequent writ attacking the effectiveness of his trial lawyers and attacking the effectiveness of the writ lawyer. Well, that old 1974 Supreme Court came up and claims that you cannot attack the effectiveness of your writ lawyer. That's what's pending in the U.S. Supreme Court. Can they change that rule? Can you now claim your lawyer is ineffective on the writ hearings? And that's what's pending for the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's why I'll be surprised if they don't grant a stay in this. I told Susan earlier I thought they'd grant a stay because that was an old 1974 case back when people who did post-conviction writs, people were on their own. Now most states are appointing lawyers to do post-conviction writs. And here's the problem. If you don't have adequate representation at the state level on a post-conviction writ, you have nothing to go to federal court on. Because the writs in federal court simply review what the state courts did and see if they follow Supreme Court law. If they don't do anything at the state level, it's called procedural default.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think I'm going to be real surprised if they don't grant a stay in this case because that 1974 Supreme Court case was based upon the premise that you're not entitled to a lawyer at the writ level, therefore you can claim the lawyer is ineffective. That's now changed because you now are getting lawyers appointed at the writ level, and therefore you should be able to claim that the lawyer is ineffective. You're not procedurally defaulted in federal court.
But as far as Garcia is concerned, this is a breakwater. This is a new plow.
Right, because I'm assuming, and I pulled tried to pull the writs out of both the Fifth Circuit and the Court of Criminal Appeals. All the Court of Criminal Appeals said in their writ he had 22 points, and we're denying all of them. They didn't say what they were. I'm assuming, since everybody's talking about mental retardation, I'm just assuming that the writ lawyers, at least according to the current lawyers, the writ lawyers didn't do a good job on doing mental retardation issue during the post-conviction writ. I'm just assuming.
Okay, now for our listeners' audience, I want you to understand that sometimes I'll throw something out in a discussion of a case that I picked up from the media, which is not the same thing as getting something from the record of the case.
Right.
And the retardation issue is something that I got from the media this afternoon.
That's where I got it, too. Because, see, I read the deal that came out of the San Antonio paper and the Houston paper today, and they had it kind of jumbled up. They thought that the retardation issue was pending the Supreme Court. That's not what's pending.
It.
What's pending is,
Can we get there?
Can you attack the writ largely be ineffective and not procedurally default in federal court? That's the issue.
Now, if you throw that on, say, a matrix of Antonin Scalia.
I think Scalia would be a good judge for this, right? Don't forget, he's the one that brought out that confrontation case. Mm-hmm. I think he'd be a good judge for this because, remember, the old law saying you couldn't attack the writ large being effective is back in 1974, and things have changed since then. I think he'd be a good judge for this. I'll be surprised if they don't grant a stay.
Yeah, well, and Scalia could do that on his own. He could say there's enough meat here on this bone. He wouldn't have to consult the other attorneys. So maybe the delay in the state responding, and this is pure speculation, is they're trying to figure out how to draft this appeal that would have the most appeal to Antonin Scalia, because if it is a legal procedural matter, Scalia is a judge subject to give that serious consideration.
Now, here's the difference. Here's where he may not do it. The Arizona case, clearly the writ lawyer was ineffective. Mm-hmm. Clearly, because here's what she did as a female. What she did is she filed a post-conviction writ during the time the direct appeal was pending.
Ooh.
And did not have the consent of Martinez to file it.
Mm.
Now, in Arizona, you can do one of two things. You can point out, number one, all the issues that you should raise in a writ, or you can say it has no merit. Now, if you say it has no merit, you got to notify your client that you've done that and give him the right to file a pro se brief. What the Arizona lawyer did, she claimed that the writ had no merit, and she wrote a letter to Martinez telling him he had the right to file a writ. Trouble is, she wrote it all in English, and he speaks only Spanish, so he didn't file a pro se writ. And so in her case, clearly the lawyer was ineffective on writ, no doubt about it. But here, it may very well be that the issue of mental retardation, which is really a hard hill to climb, may not be developed as well. And that'd be the only reason I think Scalia might deny it, because that mental retardation thing has been kind of a boogie bear that people have hung on, and it's real, real difficult.
What is the history of that? I know that the Supreme Court ruled that you can't execute somebody that's mentally retarded. What is the state of that?
Here's the problem with that. When they ruled you cannot execute mentally retarded people, they left it up to the states to set up a procedure to determine what mental retardation is. And what our courts have done, since the legislature never defined mental retardation, the Court of Criminal Appeals said mental retardation is as follows. You got to have an IQ of 70 or below. I think it's 70 or 75 below. It's got to have that IQ has got to be appear prior to the age of 18. You got to prove it through school records and things. The next thing you got to prove is you have no adaptive skills. You can't flip hamburgers at McDonald's. You can't tie your shoes.
You can't show the ability to live
that's
normally.
Right. And the problem is that has to be something that's onset before you reach the age of 18. Well, see, the reason they've done that is so you can't claim mental retardation, deliberately flunk tests when you get to TDC.
Sure.
So what you've got to fight against that is a history of people, and I don't know much about Garcia's history, but if he had a job, was able to hold it, he had adaptive skills. He might very well have had some IQ and achievement tests while he was going to elementary school that showed an IQ above 70 or 75. And see, that's a hard hill to climb. And so if the issue is that the writ lawyer is ineffective for not developing the mental retardation issue, they may blow that off because it's going to be very, very difficult to show mental retardation.
Actually, I researched a mental retardation case for Mike Charlton. Remember Mike?
Oh, sure, I know Mike.
And I was working for him as an intern one time when I was desperate for a job, and he offered me shelter. And I went over there, and he said, see what you can find in the school records of this guy.
Right.
And I found the meat. I mean, it was there. I mean, he had been IQ tested several times, elementary school, junior high school. He didn't do any senior high school at all because he didn't have apparently enough adaptive thing to make it on special education.
Right.
So we got a good case. I think they killed him anyway. But
well, see, the thing is, we've had a lot of cases here recently. They claim mental retardation with a guy scored like in the 60s at TDC. But then still you had test back when he was in elementary school, plus he had adaptive skills. It just isn't the IQ alone.
IQ alone. The number alone is not going to get it.
No. No.
Okay. Could you give Susan the microphone again? Susan, did you find anything about his prior history that indicated that he could do anything except hang around with gangs and...
Well, there wasn't his prior history. If you talk about it relative to other death penalty cases, he did not have any prior convictions. Now, the state did bring out certain things, like they said that in 1992 he had been arrested with other gang members and that he identified himself as a member of a street gang at that time.
Although, what was that, 19?
Well, I would point out if he was committed the crime in 2001, he was 28 at the time. Well, in 1992, he would be, what, 19?
19, 20, yeah. Most.
And so that there's nothing really, shall we say, no hard convictions. That his wife had gone to a battered women's shelter. And that when she went there, she said that he had physically assaulted her and emotionally abused her. And apparently, Frank Garcia had threatened to shoot a teenage boy who he accused of shooting at his vehicle. And Jessica's co-workers saw some marks or bruises on her on several occasions. And Jessica once told a co-worker, someone she was working with, that he forcibly cut her hair. So he didn't have criminal convictions, but there was...
But it was pretty rough on his women.
You know, there was obviously a little evidence there that that he wasn't an upstanding.
Yeah, but that's no indication of adaptive skills.
No.
I mean, did he provide for his family? Did he work? Is there anything that you can tell about that from what you've got?
I don't know. Jim, do you...
In this case, he was living in a house with his wife, two children, his mother and father. And I'm sure if he had had some trouble at work, this would have been brought out during the punishment hearing. Because they went so far during the punishment hearing to even get photographs of him and his wife holding firearms like people do. I mean, they were stretching to
Bonnie and Clyde stuff.
They were really stretching to show future dangerousness. Because frankly, there's not much evidence. And frankly, this is a crime of passion. And the only thing he really showed is he slapped his wife around, was a member of a gang when he was fairly young. And that's about it.
Now, if she had killed him, she'd have pretty much got her off the hook. But
Andrew Yates deal would have saved her life,
yeah,
of course.
Right, but he shot the cop first, I understand.
Yeah, that's the problem. He shot the policeman first, and then he went back and shot him a third time in the head with a high-powered rifle to make sure he was dead. And then what else hurt him during this case, when he was picked up by the police, he was real cocky, showed no remorse, didn't laugh about it, but he certainly didn't show any remorse and didn't show anything like he was sorry about it. He didn't seem to be bothered at all. It was real cool and didn't seem to bother him a whole lot. But there was nothing to indicate. Now, I'm sure had he been unemployed or had he been something like that, that would have been brought out in the punishment hearing, but it wasn't. So I'm assuming that there was no evidence of lack of adaptive skills in this case, at least nothing I could tell.
Elizabeth is in here with some kind of report.
Ray, I just got a call from the public relations officer for the Supreme Court in Washington, and she said just a few minutes ago, the Supreme Court turned down both the petitions that have been filed by Garcia's lawyers.
Okay.
And that nothing further is pending.
So nothing further is pending at this point, so we should be hearing from Glory about folks crossing the road. Well, I explained to people what's going on. Why don't you swing the microphone around to Larry Douglas? There's no sense in having him sit in here without putting that beautiful voice on the radio. My name is Ray Hill. I'm the host of the Execution Watch, and you are listening to it on HD Channel 3 at radio station KPFT Houston and on executionwatch.org. We do this show every time there is an execution scheduled, and today they had a scheduled execution for Frank Garcia. Initially, there was a delay in activity. In other words, the witnesses did not cross the road, which means that there was still pending decisions before the court. Elizabeth and Jim, in anticipation of this, prepared to tell you about the issues that would be in Washington, D.C., and speculated that it might have been successful this time. Apparently, the Supreme Court at this point has denied both pending issues, and the procedure is probably going forward, we should hear from Gloria shortly. Here we have Larry Douglas. Is there anything about this case that jumps out at you?
Maybe a little bit about this case, Ray. Jim and I were talking earlier about the potential issue of sudden passion. This case arguably might raise that issue in that his wife was in the process of leaving him, and so that issue might have been one that could have been successfully argued if the current death penalty statute allowed for that, the introduction of that kind of evidence. Unfortunately, the death penalty statute does not currently allow for sudden passion, whereas in prior death penalty statutes back in the 70s and so forth, there was a possibility of raising sudden passion. At that time, it was called murder without malice. And that would limit the amount, the level of the penalty.
Well, I overheard you and Jim discussing this out there, and it was my impression that the passion thing, except in death penalty cases, is a punishment issue and not an issue to be raised in guilt or innocence.
Currently, yes. In prior years, no. In prior years, it was an issue in guilt innocence. But when the statute was changed to require to allow that only to be used in punishment, the current version of the statute did not allow that to be done in death penalty cases. So as a result, it raises the issue that if the sudden passion issue can be raised, then perhaps the current version of the death penalty statute, the argument could be made that it might be unconstitutional, and that it does not allow for the potential for the death, for sudden passion to be raised.
So we have to wait until there is a case properly framed under that kind of claim to get to the Supreme Court to have them look at that issue, and then they're not likely to throw the whole execution statute out.
But the thing is, I'm not sure that issue was raised in this case. It would have been a good one to raise in this case. The facts are not that great for it. But a better case very well might result in the statute being revised to allow for some kind of reduction in penalty.
And then in this case, there is the officer was shot first too problem. Whereas if his wife had gotten into some kind of quarrel, or if he'd caught her with another man or something and acted on that, that would be the ideal case to bring it in.
It's not the greatest case for sudden passion, but it is a case that the potential could have been raised.
Okay, switch that around to Jim. We've got a guest here, Victoria Panetti, that we're going to be interviewing very shortly. But, Jim, what about that? What if you raise the appropriate issue in the sudden passionate case, and the Supreme Court got it, what are they likely to do with that issue?
I think it depends on the facts. Let me tell you the classic example of where it could be raised. Say, man, the key to sudden passion is what we call adequate cause. Mm-hmm. And what basically sudden passion is temporary insanity. And what the law basically says is something enrages you to the point where you're not thinking clearly and you're not using your head, you're not capable of cool reflection.
Mm-hmm.
But whatever offends you and makes you that crazy or angry has to be caused by some adequate cause. If there's adequate cause that would make any normal person enrage where they weren't thinking clearly, then that's sudden passion. In this case, the adequate cause probably is pretty slim, but a classic example would be if a man or a woman came home and found his wife or husband in bed with somebody else and shot and killed both of them. Since it's two murders in a criminal episode, that would be a capital murder case. And what happened if the prosecutors worried about the state finding that the defendant acted under sudden passion, which would reduce the sentence, all they'd have to do is file a capital murder case, waive the death penalty, and that issue's dead. Because the problem is sudden passion has been submitted at a punishment hearing, and there's no punishment hearing if you seek the death penalty and waive the death penalty.
Because once you get to the punishment phase, it's you've got three questions to ask.
Well, that's in a death penalty. But when you waive the death penalty, it's an automatic life. You don't even have a punishment hearing.
Oh, okay.
And see, sudden passion's issued is given to you at a punishment hearing. So what happens if a prosecutor, in a case where a man comes home, finds somebody in bed with his wife and kills both of them? That's capital murder, because it's two murders in one criminal episode.
Sure.
Then the next thing, if they want to avoid a sudden passion charge or instruction, which will reduce the punishment range from 2 to 20, all they'd have to do is file it as capital murder, not seek the death penalty. And if that person's found guilty, it's an automatic life. That's the end of it. And they knock out the sudden passion issue. And that set of facts, I think they made it clear the statute
and
constitution.
And that's at the total discretion of the district attorney.
That's the problem. As Larry talked about prosecutorial discretion, you're absolutely right. They could knock out the sudden passion issue.
Another thing, while I've got you on the microphone, Vicky Panetti is going to be our next interview. Vicky's brother has a long history of mental struggles, paranoid schizophrenia, all of that. It's been previously diagnosed. He was treated with it. He had it according to military doctors and civilian doctors and all of that. Why is it that the Supreme Court has decided that it's illegal to execute folks suffering retardation, but that does not extend to mental illness?
We have argued that over and over again. In fact, that really the case where people should be going with this is mental retardation destroys your culpable mental state. That should be a defense to it. Because the problem is we're using that old definition of insanity as a defense. And what we're basically saying under the law is that if you can be crazy, and really crazy, but if you can distinguish right from wrong, that is not a defense. But you could be crazy as a lunatic and still be legally sane.
And so evidence like you left the scene trying to get away.
If you do, you're exactly right. That's what they look at. They look at the conduct after the killing is over with. And if the person does something to try to hide it, what does that indicate? They knew what they did was wrong. Even though they were crazy when they did it, then under the law they were considered legally sane. And I think the reason I think they're so reluctant to change that, they don't want to have a battle of psychiatrists, because the truth of the matter is, if you got enough money, you can hire a psychiatrist to say anything.
Sure.
And that's the problem they're trying to face, is how do you get over this battle of experts? But I think the law on insanity is stupid. It's just crazy.
I went because prisons are full of mental health people.
Sure.
I mean, not just death row, but all of prisons are full of mental
health
people.
That ends in becoming old folks home in a mental institution.
Yeah, and so I attended a lecture by William Wayne Justice one time at, of all places, Baylor Medical School. And I went over there, and he had been invited to speak on criminal justice and mental health. I think what they were looking for was his comments on what happens to people with mental health problems in prison. That's not what he talked about. He being an old criminal defense lawyer, he talked about mental health and criminal defense.
Right.
And basically his conclusion was that the judges are limited.
Sure they are.
In the scope of what they can consider in a case where somebody with serious mental health problems has been convicted in their courts of doing crimes. And he speculated the kinds of cases that might raise that issue for possible appellate reconsideration.
The big issue that we're trying to get dealt is what we call you're so crazy you can't form a couple of mental states, called diminished capacity. Mm-hmm. Because of mental illness, you may have diminished capacity to form an intent to do something. But they've shot that down consistently.
Okay, I have a report coming in hot off the presses from Elizabeth.
Yeah, Ray, I just heard from Gloria, and she said the witnesses just crossed the street.
All right, I will tell our audience what that means, is that under normal circumstances, Frank Garcia will be dead before the end of this hour. When the witnesses cross the street, the process from there usually takes about 20 or 25 minutes. We go off this radio show at 7 o'clock. The chances of Mr. Garcia still being alive at 7 o'clock Houston time are very remote. The witnesses have crossed the street. First, the witnesses from the media, and then anyone witnessing from Mr. Garcia's side will cross the road, and they'll go to the death chamber, and they will begin the procedure. Mr. Garcia is already on the gurney. The needles are already in his arm. They will open the curtain. The warden will ask him for last words, and then the execution will begin. The processes will begin with chemicals coursing in his veins. He's going to be dead, probably, before this show goes off the air. When that is over, the people from Carnes Funeral Services will pick up his body in death chamber, carry it out the back gate at the Walls, and carry it to a little Baptist church in the neighborhood where his family can go visit the body while there is still warmth, and it'll be the first time his family has touched his body since he went to death row. Our guest now is Victoria Panetti, who has dealt with the reality of that problem today. You visited your brother today.
I visited him yesterday, yeah.
But you were still in Livingston today.
Correct, yeah.
What was that like?
It's hard to see your loved one suffering, you know, behind glass. You can't hug them or, you know, try to help take away some of their pain. And in Scott's case, you know, he's a schizophrenic, has been in over a dozen mental institutions, VA and private, you know.
You heard me and Jim talking about the differential between mental illness and mental retardation in capital cases. What is your opinion of that differential?
My opinion is that something has to be done with the definition of these terms of insanity. In my brother's case, it's very clear and documented by VA and private hospitals that he has psychosis and schizophrenia. And I think that it should be taken into account what the history of that who is the person who is accused has gone through, you know. And I think that it's wrong to execute mentally ill and mentally challenged people. It's wrong.
How long has your brother been on the road?
Since 1995.
And he was, has he had a scheduled execution date?
He did in 2004, and then it was stayed. So we had a funeral planned, and the day before we were called, our family, and told that Scott got a stay. So then in 2006, April 2006, it reached the Supreme Court, and I went to that hearing. And the Supreme Court ruled 5-4 not to execute him and gave the case back to the Texas courts. And now we are in limbo, and our family waits again, you know, and waiting on a decision from the district court.
And where is that district court?
Austin.
Okay, so it's a district's appeal court. Because he was actually convicted in what jurisdiction?
Gillespie County.
Gillespie County.
And his trial was held only 30 minutes away, which we, you know, protested against. That it was a small town and only 30 minutes away, the jury couldn't possibly be fair. We wanted to have his trial in Austin.
You did an application for change of venue, and they didn't grant that.
Yeah, we had to do it in Kerrville. Then my mother wrote a letter to the judge, Judge Stephen Abels, and begged him not to let my brother be his own attorney. He was so paranoid. I met with my brother in the Kerrville jail, and the police put me in a room with my brother, and there were pens and pencils on the table, and he was screaming psychotically, and I was about 24 years old and a college student, and there I was with my brother who had just killed some people, and they left me in a room locked in with him, and he was screaming under the door at the cops, and that's how I was treated.
The judge in this trial allowed a brother who had a long history of mental problems
to be
his own attorney.
He fired his lawyers out of paranoia. He thought they were out to get him. He had two lawyers that our family liked that worked on the case for a few years and then let them go.
and this case is still pending.
Correct, yeah. Yes.
In the District Court of Appeals. You don't know whether it's a three-judge panel considering it or the en banc?
I'm sorry, I don't know that. I wish, you know, that's why I'm here in Texas, to find some answers. I attended the march to show my support to everyone who lives in Texas who's fighting the death penalty. I have a lot of answers that I need, questions I need answered. I want to, you know, check in with Texas Defender Service, and who's in Austin and has been working on my brother's case, and touch base with them and see if they are diligently trying very hard to help my brother.
And you recently went to Austin to the big march and rally against executions on the Austin Capitol ground?
Right, on last Saturday.
Did that help you feel not as alone?
Definitely. And there are so many family members that suffer from this. For example, my brother shot his in-laws, his wife's parents, and they have a daughter. So not only has she suffered the loss of growing up without grandparents, now this girl is facing possible execution of her father, and she doesn't want Scott to be murdered by the state. She doesn't want him to be executed. So here we have a victim.
And how old is she now?
She's 20.
20.
I think. Around
you can't 20. Go through these kind of experiences without scars from the crime itself and then from the punishment of the crime.
Yeah, it's a circle of violence. And if we stop this violence, you know, at a high level of law, then the world will be a better place. You know, if we'd stop this.
Where do you live now?
Switzerland.
And how long have you lived in Switzerland?
3 years.
How long have you been a singer?
My whole life.
Your whole life?
Yeah, my mother was a deacon at the Presbyterian church, and she sang in the choir. So,
you come
I would
up
sing
with those
in the
notes
church.
In your head.
Yeah, I'd sing in the church, and Scott actually helped build the sanctuary of that church with the rocks from our parents' ranch in Fredericksburg. He helped haul those rocks and build that Christian church, And so whenever people say that that inmates always just turn Christian or religious after they get into prison, that's not true.
He went to the service?
He was in the early and mid-70s. He was special intelligence with the Navy, went through a lot of special intelligence training. Scott is a very smart man. And however, smart people can become very sick with schizophrenia. And it's a disease, just like cancer, it's a diseased mind. It's like heart disease. And for me, it's like dealing with a family member with a terminal illness. It's like waiting for that person to maybe die. And maybe some people know out there what that feels like, waiting for a loved one to die, and that's what I've been dealing with, and my mother and father and brother, all of our family has dealt with this, and his children. Scott has children, so they deal with this too.
Our interview guest today is Victoria Panetti. She has, you've heard her before, she provides the opening and closing music for our show since the very beginning of Execution Watch. Her brother is on death row, and she's been in Livingston, Texas. What are the conditions on death row now?
Well, I watch what people are writing on Facebook and the internet, and I hear and see and read a lot of concerns about the mail room and the delivery of mail, and the inmates are complaining, some of them, that their mail is not sent out on time. My brother doesn't get his reading material. It's given to other inmates sometimes. You know, and can you imagine 23 hours a day you're locked in what looks like your bathroom at home?
Yeah.
And reading material is very important. And
Vicky,
and
I lived in
write.
Prison. I know what those cells look like.
Yeah, it's like being locked in your bathroom at home 23 hours a day. And so this is important to these guys. And I hope that the guards realize that it's not their duty to punish. Their punishment is their freedoms taken away, and they are living in solitary confinement,
awaiting execution.
So, from what I've heard, right now, Scott is unmedicated, schizophrenic, living in solitary, and his life is definitely not comfortable. It's hard on all of us.
How did you come about writing a song about executions?
It was because I lived in Los Angeles, and I used the resources around me to use whatever I could to gain awareness about my, brother schizophrenic on death row. And I was a makeup artist, and I still am, but I used people as celebrity to gain awareness. And people like Susan Sarandon and others who are on the website for my brother, you can see their photos and who they are, contributed to this fight for his life and fight for justice. It's mostly about justice here because of his trial was so seriously flawed.
And what is that website?
It's either Save Scott Panetti or Rap and Rock the Death Clock.com. There is a documentary called Executing the Insane, William Kunstler's the lawyer from the 60s. His daughters made a website with Phil Donahue. I'm sorry, a documentary with Phil Donahue narrating. It's about 20 minutes, and I urge everyone listening to please look at this website.
Put Scott Panetti in your search engine. It'll come up. What follows is Victoria's song. Thank you for being on the show, Victoria.
Oh, thank you.
Don't you know they're killing people? Don't you know they're killing people?